Welcome to the inaugural edition of Conversations at the Computational Justice Lab. I'm Greg D'Angelo, the director of the Computational Justice Lab, and on this edition, we are honored to welcome Professor Susan Athey, the Economics of Technology professor at Stanford University, and also the director of the Golub's Capital Social Impact Lab and associate director of the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. Additionally, Professor Athey has been awarded the prestigious John Bates Clark Medal, among many other accolades, and this year was awarded the John von Neumann Award. Susan, congratulations, and thanks so much for stopping by, given your dizzyingly busy schedule.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, so thank you for stopping by again. We want to just talk with you a little bit, not on all your technical work, although there's a lot of that out there, but just a little bit about you and how you've gotten to where you're at in the world. So I'm going to start at a sort of 30,000 foot view with this first question, but I think it's an important one. So you are the Economics of Technology professor. Can you give us a bit of background about why you hold this specific title?
I guess the origin of the title is a little bit arbitrary in a way that we're trying to come up with a title that captured the breadth of what I was working on. And at the time, actually, I liked it okay. And now, maybe 5 years later, I like it even better because I do think it captures a lot of the breadth of what I'm interested in. I think there's different themes in my research from, you know, machine learning and methods to marketplaces and platforms and, you know, experimentation. All of these things are part of tech economics. Mm-hmm. And so when you think of the economics of technology, tech economics is part of that. And so why do I say tech economics? That's all the kinds of economics that come up in working with tech firms. But then another component is the impact of technology on the economy and on firms, business, governments, et cetera, which is really another strand of focus for both my teaching and my research. So it's actually turned out to be, I think, a pretty good catch-all in a world where actually it can be pretty hard to put a name on all these disparate areas. I should say one other thing about that is that actually it's not unique to me. I think a lot of the economists who have had some interface with the technology community have worked on what at first seem to be disparate areas, but actually are kind of tied together in some broad way. Yeah. And a lot of the questions we have recently about the role of technology in our society, like in politics and what news people get in privacy and so on, also kind of fall under that general purview of both. You have to think about issues as you're building the technology to implement digital services, but there's also questions about the impact of those services on the way our society functions.
Absolutely. You know, as a sort of mid-career economist, it's been fun to have grown up in this environment and really kind of be a part of it. It's, it's really been fascinating. And I feel like it's an incredibly rewarding space too. But one of the things that does make you a little more unique, I know you're trying to say you're not, but I think you're pretty darn unique, but that makes you a bit more unique is that you spend a lot of time as the economist, and I think you spent a number of years as the only economist in these Silicon Valley firms. And that's starting to change, and it has been changing for quite some time. But why does Silicon Valley need economists?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is just at a very high level, a lot of the most impactful Silicon Valley firms have been not just inventing technology, but they've been changing business models. They have been changing industry structure. And so economics is really important for understanding strategy at a very high level. You know, mm-hmm. What businesses do you enter? What do you buy? What are your competitors going to do? There's been a lot of horizontal and vertical integration. And so understanding the economic incentives for that vertical and horizontal integration, and also understanding sources of market power and the consequences of market power for the surrounding firms are just central to the existential, really, for the large tech platforms and also for smaller tech platforms. So if I work with a lot of startups, and if a startup is going to enter and grow, they need to think about, where are they going to get customers? What's Google going to do? Is Google going to allow them to reach their customers, or are they going to prevent them from reaching their customers? Are the services that the startup's providing, are they going to get integrated or absorbed into a larger firm? So those are really fundamentally economic issues. Now, historically, business people kind of figured that stuff out. And if you are in an industry that's fairly stable and that has a lot of sort of common rules of thumb, then, you know, having an MBA background is sufficient to kind of learn and understand those rules and internalize them. But if you're in an environment where things are changing, you're encountering types of, products or business models or industry structures that haven't been seen before, then the training of an economist is really useful for thinking through what is a stable equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And if you see something unstable, that's very important. If you say, here's something like YouTube that, in principle, it could or should be a standalone firm in some way, mm-hmm. but there's going to be very strong strategic incentives for somebody like Google to buy it. Because if their competitor buys it, that would help their competitor compete against Google.
Yeah.
So these types of really thinking through those industry structure questions is one big thing. A second really big bucket revolves around data science and how data is used to make decisions. And so, if you think about what we're training most of our master's students and a lot of our PhD students to do in computer science and engineering, there's been a lot of emphasis on using really amazing advanced new techniques to solve prediction and classification problems. There's a lot of emphasis on doing a great job solving problems where you can evaluate right away whether you did a good job. So you can take your algorithm for telling cats and dogs apart. You can immediately look at the output of that algorithm and say, yeah, I got the right answer. And in those types of environments, we can think about machine learning as sort of automating a lot of data science in a way. If you have a clear objective, you can measure success well, then it's very easy to let a robot go out and build your statistical models. One way I talk about neural nets is it's sort of like your robot is doing is building your model, and they're trying billions of variations where the human research assistant might only try, 10 or 15 variations. And it's really powerful to try a couple billion. but you can only automate certain components of data science.
Mm-hmm.
And other parts still require a lot of craft and conceptual thinking. For example, just thinking, if I had an infinite data set, is it possible I could answer my question of interest? We call that identification in economics. And that's a really core concept that has not been the focus of most of what we've trained machine learners for. And so questions like, what would happen if I changed my price? What would happen if I introduced a new product? What would happen if two companies merged?
Mm-hmm.
Those types of questions are questions that require not just a robotic research assistant to build an amazingly good predictive model. They require thinking about what in my data could help, it could even possibly answer the question about these counterfactuals.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great point. I mean, I think you were just speaking to, we actually hit my next question already. So I got a twofer on that one. But you're speaking to an interesting part, which is that data scientists really haven't been trained in the causal methods. But we, on the other side, as economists, that's a big part of the way, especially young economists are being trained, is like, you have to find the causal effect. And so I have noticed, maybe it's just the people I hang out with, but I have noticed some pushback from sort of the causal folks when it comes to the use of some of these machine learning techniques and integrating them into the causal toolbox, if you will. But this is something that you have been at the frontier on. And so for the aspiring young econometricians out there who are thinking through, we know all of the regression discontinuities and all these different techniques and synthetic control and diff that exists. What's the role of what the data scientists and the computer scientists on the machine learning side have brought to the table? What's the role of that in this causal revolution that we're all a part of right now?
Well, I think the good news from the economist, causal economist, applied microeconomist side is that, you know, the value of what we know has never been greater because we have more opportunities to use these methods in a credible way. All of the different experiments and product introductions that and just general digitization of government services, of governments interacting mm-hmm. with their citizens through the criminal justice system, but also through service provision. So we have data about lots and lots of things, and we're having lots more interventions because digital services can be changed more often. You have designed experiments, but you also have natural experiments just coming from the introduction and changes in the digitization of services. So there's lots of opportunity. And the benefits of understanding impacts have never been greater because, of course, it's not just for scientists kind of looking down into the lab, but actually we're in a world where it's possible to take action. The costs of taking action to implement policy changes of some kinds have never been lower because we're digital. In any policy that where some aspect of its implementation is digitized, the cost of change have never been lower. And we can provide services to people at moments where they have low opportunity costs of their time. So we can reach people with services in a way while they're sitting on the bus, while they're at home at night after their kids go to bed. We can reach people with services, information, and training and so on in times that haven't been there before. So the benefits of doing all this have never been higher. And at some level, we've done a pretty good job thinking about what kinds of designs allow credible causal inference. Mm-hmm. Causal panel data models, regression discontinuity, instrumental variables. Some level, if somebody comes up with a new one, that's great. But we've thought pretty hard mm-hmm. about what those designs look like. I think the main types of designs we haven't thought about as much in economics are ones that come from algorithms. So one of the things I'm working on are drawing inference from Bandit data, reinforcement learning data. So we haven't spent as much time on that in economics because we historically didn't have data generated that way. But at a high level, it's unconfoundedness just with different kinds of correlations mm-hmm. and things like that. But broadly, we've identified the big ways that you can draw causal inference that are likely to be there in practice. So what is left? And I think part of the reaction of the causal inference people is, well, I thought the only important thing was identification, and so if you're not bringing me new identification, then how could it matter? The way I think about it is, yes, the identification strategies are fairly well studied, and in fact, the semi-parametric econometrics is also fairly well studied, which basically is saying, like, if I had infinite data and I wanted to be really flexible in various ways, what is the best way I could combine that data to draw efficient inference if I'm thinking about data sets getting larger and being able to be very flexible with my functional forms. Where have we failed? Well, if you look out in practice, a lot of the papers in practice are not robust, not replicable, sensitive to functional forms. And so in practice, the problems people are facing are taking those beautiful theoretical ideas, justifying the assumptions, always big, very important. But then once you've gotten there, trying to actually come up with estimates that you can trust and where you're not at risk of somebody replicating it and flipping the sign or, showing there is something wrong with it by making some minor change in the specification. So that's the piece where I think machine learning comes in. It's going to automate the search for flexible functional forms, and it's going to make your work replicable. So it allows you to, instead of trying 200 specifications in a spreadsheet and hoping you've tried all the important ones and you didn't flip your sign or change your results too much, instead you're trying billions of specifications. And so you can be very confident as a researcher that, the functional form part of your model has been fully explored and that you are in fact telling your audience. And if you try, say, three or four machine learning methods, like forest and tree-based methods, lasso-based methods, neural net methods, that's in the cross section and in the panel setting, different kinds of matrix completion. But if you've tried the big buckets, then within those buckets, you know, lots of specifications have been tried automatically, you can be fairly certain that in try some averages of all of them, you can be fairly certain that sort of the flexible non-parametric part of your model has been well covered.
Yeah.
Now, I alluded at a high level to semi-parametric econometrics. That's basically what that literature often says is that I'm going to, if I'm starting to solve this particular problem, this is the way, in, here's a set of, say, doubly robust scores, and the best way to understand average treatment effects under unconfoundedness is to construct a doubly robust score. The doubly robust score, for example, would have a couple of nuisance parameters, like a conditional mean, an outcome model, as well as a model for the assignment of the treatment. And so in that specific example, what do I mean by the flexible part of the model or the non-parametric part of the model? That those are the parts where you estimate the outcome model flexibly, where you estimate the weighting function flexibly. Those parts are outsourced beautifully to machine learning. Mm-hmm. But the functional form of a doubly robust score, the fact that you need a doubly robust score at all, a doubly robust approach is going to allow you to be robust to the errors in the outcome model or errors in estimating the treatment assignment model. That was known. And yes, machine learning doesn't change that. There was truth. There was a right answer. There were theorems that told you this is the best way to use the data. The machine learning is going to operationalize it, make it work in a replicable way. We've had to modify all of these things. So we've actually figured out that, you know, you need to do things like cross-fitting. So don't use the same data to estimate the model and to predict the nuisance parameters. We've thought about different types, other ways to modify the machine learning models to give them even better properties for this purpose. And then also, you know, historically, there was a lot more ambiguity, like, is doubly robust really the right way to go? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out in a world where you're building rich, flexible models, so double robustness actually performs better. Well, in the small data literature, well, sometimes propensity weighting, sometimes outcome modeling, sometimes doubly robust. Generally, we're finding that in the big data setting, that these kinds of doubly robust mm-hmm. methods win.
Yeah.
And that's basically because you're in a world where you aren't going to get the outcome model right, and you're not going to get the assignment model right, and you're acknowledging that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, these kinds of robustness or orthogonality properties have a higher comparative advantage. But like very high level, you know, it's the same math, the same statistics that we got out of the theoretical literature. Just people weren't using it because either it didn't work or the things were fragile. And now the machine learning, I think, brings them to their full glory. Mm-hmm. So just to summarize, to the causal inference person, yes, absolutely, you're right. I agree. Machine learning doesn't give you new identification strategies, and all the things you know are super important. And no, you can't throw them out just because machine learning came along. But machine learning can help you execute in a much more convincing mm-hmm. and credible and replicable way.
Yeah, well put. I appreciate that. I want to give you a quick chance to plug your lab, if you don't mind. Tell us just a little bit about the lab and maybe a project that you are really excited about that's coming out of the lab.
Sure. So the Gold Capital Social Impact Lab, we just launched with our new name in the last, 6 weeks or so. Very excited. So I had never actually imagined that I would have a lab. But one of the things I learned with working with tech companies is, first of all, how important it is to actually build the things if you care about getting it right. Mm-hmm. So if you thought about being an economist as a consultant inside a firm and just giving advice and throwing it over the transom, you had very limited things you could try. Mm-hmm. But if you actually embed yourself in an engineering team and collaborate with them, mm-hmm. then you can achieve so much more economics because you can continue to iterate and mm-hmm. improve your interventions. But that really requires both being part of the team just organizationally, but also understanding the real engineering constraints and implementation constraints so that out of all the economic interventions and things you might try, that you pick the ones that you can build and iterate on most quickly and that best accommodate the constraints of the environment. So I learned all of that, you know, in the tech world. I spent time at Microsoft, and then afterwards I joined a bunch of boards, and so I was advising a lot of for-profit firms. They were actually happy for me to do research in collaboration with them, but you do get into conflict issues there because the most interesting and fundamental questions for the firms often also have confidentiality issues, strategic mm-hmm. issues, and so on. And so I was trying to think about how could I make the research, how could I bring more out of the firms? It's not that the firms minded sharing the research generally. It's just that there's, you know, a variety of kind of small sensitivities that can just add up to get in the way. And so I wanted to think from a research perspective, just how can I teach the world about all of these techniques that are getting developed inside of tech firms and all of the insights. At the same time, I also felt, you know, while of course things like search engines and advertising are super important for the economy because they're how do consumers find prices? How do firms get discovered? How does competition work? At some level, they are fundamental from an efficiency perspective. There's still a feeling that, you know, collaborating with a tech firm to work on advertising is maybe not as exciting as directly helping people.
Right.
And especially think about all the problems we're facing in the world today. There's a drive I had as a social scientist to maybe, you know, instead of just making the whole economy more efficient, like let's go and try to fix a specific problem
yeah.
and get a little bit closer to the ground on social problems. And so I realized that collaborating with social impact firms, either small social startups or large for-profits, but in their capacity of helping people, so a lot of them have projects that are not for a profit motive. I could actually solve both of these problems. I could do science and generate new scientific insights working with a large at-scale consumer population, which is required mm-hmm. to really use these techniques yeah. To their full potential. And I could solve problems at the same time, like directly impact social problems. And I would have much less problem with the publication and the IP and the confidentiality because even the for-profit firms aren't going to have sensitivities about their, you know, social impact mm-hmm. work.
Right.
And once all of that clicked together, it felt so obvious, you know, just even saying it, it's like, oh, duh, of course. Why wouldn't you think of that? But I think maybe the thing I wasn't as sure of is how much receptivity would there be for this thing that made a lot of sense to me. And the thing that's been really exciting is that actually as I went out and started talking to social impact firms, the message was so resonant. And I think one reason is that actually there's such a lack of skills out there. There's lots of people inside of big tech firms who have skills, but for a social impact firm to access the talent and the expertise and the experience with the wages that Silicon Valley pays today mm-hmm. to good data scientists, which are incredibly high, they just can't afford the best people. And then, okay, they could get interns from a university, but then those interns need guidance and they also don't have the bandwidth or the capacity or the ability really to supervise the interns. Mm-hmm. And so this, I realized that there was this gap in terms of matchmaking that I have at Stanford, I have a university full of students who would love to get real world experience and take what they've learned in the classroom and apply it to a social impact organization. And their skills are lacking in that they've learned how to download data sets from the web and, you know, run neural nets on them, or they've learned how to, you know, make mice run through mazes or something digitally, you know, and play video games. But there's a lot of additional skills they haven't learned that would come in applying those in practice. So they need those skills and they would love to get internships. Sure, they could go get an internship targeting ads at Google if they can get it. But they would also much rather have an internship that's helping teach people, helping retrain people, helping provide social services. So there is this supply and demand. The students have the supply of labor. The companies have the demand for labor. The challenge, the friction, is actually making that labor supply productive in an environment of scarce resources and bandwidth on the receiving firm. So what we've done in our lab is we've decided to go out and create partnerships. We've hired postdocs who are more mature in their research and also their ability to manage projects and so on. They are a point of interface with our social impact partners. Then those postdocs in turn can supervise PhD students and master students and undergraduates who want to supply their labor and learn skills. But I have more senior kind of research personnel who are able to make sure that they're done effectively and efficiently and they aren't wasting the partner's time.
Yeah.
And then out of all of that, we publish papers, both about what we've learned about what works to solve a specific problem, but also exemplars of how do you do personalization? How do you do personalization if you're a small startup app and you're just growing? How do you do personalization if you're a large tech firm with a large footprint trying to provide social services? Where is it beneficial to really get the right service to the right person at the right time? And what vectors what dimensions of differentiation are very important for personalization? And you know, what frictions are people facing? What's really stopping someone from taking advantage of training or some kind of government program? We can test all of that and then generalize these insights out, teach the rest of the social impact space, and also NGOs. So I've done a bunch of training with the World Bank already. We have, and of course, the World Bank has people all over the world who are ready to go out and learn and implement things. So we can really scale our impact by teaching what we've learned to you know all these people on the ground all over the world.
Yeah, it's really inspirational and a guiding force for somebody like me who's trying to start a lab, and you have much more experience in this space. But it's really useful. And I will say that, you know, for me personally, you are a guiding force for me in terms of my, you know, next steps and how to think about, you know, which projects to take on and which ones that, you know, maybe won't work. And it's all that knowledge is needed. It's desperately needed by, in the world and for people like myself, but also for the partnering agencies that are out there. So we have to wrap up here, unfortunately. I'd hang out with you all day and chat if I could. But if you get a chance, you should check out Susan's website, where there's a tremendous amount of information there about what she's up to. Sometimes you can maybe catch her while she's on the road. She is basically like a touring band. She's all over the place these days. But we really want to thank you for stopping by for this week's episode of Conversations at the Computational Justice Lab. For those of you listening, if you'd like to check out this content and other content, you should visit our webpage at www.computationaljusticelab.org. And from there, you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And once again, thanks to Professor Athey for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me here.